Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
There is an existential threat to Torres Islanders like Uncle Popeye and Uncle Paul, and it's imperative that the Commonwealth take action or they literally will lose their homeland and tens of thousands of years of culture.
Torres Strait Islander activists have lost their years-long court case over climate change and duty of care. We find out how this will transpire. We find out what will happen going forward. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. But first, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese was walking along the Great Wall of China today with his fiancée, Jodie Hayden. This is the PM's second visit to the country since 2023. Carlos Xi asked Dr. David Goodman, Professor of Chinese Politics and Director of the China Study Centre at the University of Sydney, if there was any hope for the buyback agreement of Port Darwin becoming a reality.
If I was a betting man, which I'm not, I wouldn't put money on the buyback going ahead. There are, of course, a number of issues between China and Australia which were not mentioned in the discussions that we saw on television or reported in the media, both in China and here. But that doesn't mean that those issues are not being discussed. And, of course, the fate of the Port of Darwin is one of those. And there are a couple of others as well, of course, like the fate of Yang Chunhun, who's in prison in China. But that doesn't mean, as I say, that doesn't mean they weren't being discussed and won't be discussed, both whilst Albanese is in China, in meetings between officials on both sides, and also before and after.
This tour as well is a significant opportunity for Australia and China's relationship to sort of rebuild as there is that regained trust and trade relations. In terms of the visit in itself, it seems that China is making efforts to please Australia's PM with their hospitality. Why now?
When the Albanese government came into power in 2022, things started to change, and I think there's been, you know, the kind of process by which governments who have some intemperate observations over time find that they feel each other out to see how things can improve. Why would we want a better, to balance that relationship? I mean, we might want to balance it differently, but assuming that the current relationship that we have with the USA is in Australia's interests, that's a big ask. It's not proving to be the case now, and it didn't prove to be the case before. When sanctions were imposed on us, it was the USA that jumped into the trade space with China. So I don't know, you know, why are we following an America as number one policy for Australia? It doesn't seem to me to make any sense. China is, as you've just pointed out, our number one trading partner in both directions. We buy from more people and we sell to more people than we do with the USA.
I guess on the ground level, how can this trip sort of tell Australians that China is sort of a power to trust as well? Because I think there is a little bit of anti-China sentiment amongst Australians as well.
Oh, there is. There's no question about it. And there has been for at least since 1900. It's a difficult thing to get over. I don't think, to be frank, I don't think one should ever trust the government of any other country too much. The example of America, the USA, proves that, doesn't it? I mean, the talk about, oh, we can rely on our American allies because we share the same values, would seem not to be true at the moment, and it may not have ever been true. I think I heard John Howard saying that once. What we need is to ensure that we are safe in our own, in what we do.
The University of Sydney's Dr. David Goodman, Professor of Chinese Politics, speaking there with Carlos Xi.
Hey there, we're the Warren Miller Band and you're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
In 2021, First Nations leaders Uncle Pabai and Uncle Paul sued the Commonwealth over climate change negligence in the Torres Strait region. Yesterday, the decision of the Pabai case was handed down, finding that the Australian government does not have a duty of care to protect Torres Strait residents from climate change. Marlena Holderness has this story.
Sea levels in the Torres Strait are rising at almost three times the global average and have risen 6 centimetres over the last decade alone. Torres Strait traditional owners Uncle Pabai and Uncle Paul took the Australian government to court in October 2021 for failing to protect their communities from exacerbated climate change. Yesterday, a decision was handed down. Justice Jason Wigney found that, quote, the Commonwealth did not and does not owe Torres Strait Islanders the duty of care alleged by the applicants in support of their primary case. I asked Brett Spiegel, principal lawyer at Fee Finney McDonald, the law firm that represented Uncle Pabai and Uncle Paul, why this case was so important.
You know, this case, it's hard to imagine a more important case than this one. As Justice Wigney recognized in his statements yesterday, there is an existential threat to Torres Strait Islanders like Uncle Pabai and Uncle Paul. And it's imperative that the Commonwealth take action or they literally will lose their homeland and tens of thousands of years of culture.
His reaction to yesterday's outcome was mixed.
On the one hand, I was heartened by the fact that His Honor recognized that there is this existential threat to Torres Strait Islanders and that he accepted the evidence put forward by the different islanders who gave evidence in the case. Obviously, I was not pleased with the fact that the court reached the conclusion that it wasn't in a position to do anything about these problems. And ultimately, that's the key issue that we're going to have to consider in determining whether or not to seek to appeal the judgment.
Dr. Ella Vines, climate law expert at Monash University Business School's Green Lab, was saddened but not surprised by the court's decision.
I want to emphasise that the judge in his decision yesterday said that the facts of climate change are unequivocal and that the climate change impacts that are and will continue to be suffered by Torres Strait Islanders is unequivocal. But what he said is that the law of tort, as it stands, cannot offer redress in this instance. But there are pathways for legal development in higher courts or through law reform in the parliament. And indeed, the applicants said yesterday in their press conference that they intend to continue pursuing their extraordinary leadership on behalf of their communities as far as possible. But then there's also law reform options in the parliament as well.
Judge Wigney stated that the court's findings, quote, should not be construed as somehow sanctioning or justifying the unquestionably modest and unambitious greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets that were set by the Commonwealth in 2015, 2020 and 2021. I asked Dr. Ella Vines what changes the government should be making.
If you factor in Australia's ongoing fossil fuel use, including its exports, Australia is the second largest climate polluter when calculated by total carbon emissions from its fossil fuel exports. So we have a process under Australia's Climate Change Act for our emissions reductions targets to be reviewed and to be based on expert evidence by the Independent Climate Change Authority. But I think this case certainly puts a spotlight on and underscores the need for our next round of emissions reduction targets to be more ambitious and to accord with Australia contributing to global efforts.
The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has found that more than 1 billion people living in coastal areas globally are at risk of rising sea levels by 2050. Lawyer Brett Spiegel says the Pabai case is just one step in the larger process of global climate litigation.
I think that the precedent that it sets from a factual perspective, it goes farther than most previous cases in identifying the problem. Of course, the fact that that next step was one that the court was unable to take is disappointing. But if one's familiar with the Mabo case leading to native title, Mabo didn't win in the first instance either. And so we aren't at this point thinking of this as something that's negative ultimately for climate litigation, but a step in the process.
Brett Spiegel, principal lawyer at Fee Finney McDonald, speaking there with Marlena Holderness. President Donald Trump has pledged to deliver billions of dollars of US military equipment to Ukraine, including Patriot missile defense systems, with NATO footing the bill. President Trump has also threatened to further sanction Russia in 50 days if steps towards ending the war are not taken. In spite of these measures, experts are skeptical of this deal's capacity to broker a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine. George Popel has more.
While Trump's pledge to supply Ukraine of new missiles and threaten economic sanctions on Russia could be seen as a positive step towards a ceasefire, many diplomats in Russia have dismissed the deal, with former President Dmitry Medvedev calling the deal a theatrical ultimatum. Associate Professor at Curtin University, Alexei Muraviev, claims Russia would not be surprised by the new deal.
Well, when it comes to public rhetoric, it doesn't seem to show that the Russians have concern, also because they now been subjected to most severe sanctions since early 2022, and even before that, they lived under sanctions. So for them, an imposition of yet another round of sanctions is not something that would catch them by surprise.
With NATO paying for new weapons going to Ukraine, this deal marks a moment of Trump putting economic responsibility for Ukraine onto Europe.
What Trump managed to achieve, he managed to effectively shift the burden of future provisions of weapons onto European taxpayers. And that's been a long-standing goal of Trump, even during his first term in the office, because he was the one that initiated initial weapon supplies to Ukraine. But he kept making it quite clear that the business of Ukraine should really be a European business, not the business of the United States.
The 50-day grace period given to Russia may also be understood as an opportunity for Russian aggression in Ukraine.
We also need to understand that 50 days that Trump gave to Putin, it can also be viewed as a timeline to the Ukrainians, because I seriously doubt that the Russians are not going to simply sit and wait for this timeline to disappear. They will intensify the advance. They capture Ukrainian settlements every day, and one can expect actually an intensification of that assault, and that partially explains why there is a lot of skepticism in Ukraine about this Trump's announcement, because some Ukrainians believe, and that includes parliamentarians, that this is a way for Trump to give more Ukraine to Putin rather than support Ukraine.
There is also the risk that Trump's proposed economic sanctions against Russia are too harsh and could, in the future, lead to an increase in economic hostility with China.
It may certainly be something that would not resonate well, not only with Moscow, but also with countries that may fall under sanctions, because the sanctions are not just targeting the Russians. If you read the provisions carefully, they're also aiming at those countries who benefit from doing energy trade with Russia, and certainly the first two powers that instantaneously come to mind are China and India. So does Trump want to risk further escalation of trade war with China, given the fact that the two countries already engaged in the terrorist war? And does Trump want to escalate the U.S. relationship or jeopardize U.S. relationship with India? Because India is quite proud to retain its strategic philosophy based on strategic autonomy. So for them to comply with U.S. sanctions, meaning that India would no longer be able to claim that it runs independent or sovereign foreign policy. So I think there's going to be a lot of thinking in Washington, and certainly on Trump's part, on how to proceed once 50 days will expire. Or, you know, in 50 days from now, we might just forget about this whole thing, because Trump may decide to move on or agree that another resolution would be presented by then.
Associate Professor Alexei Muraviev from Curtin University speaking there with George Popel. You're listening to The Wire, broadcasting all around Australia. And a big hello if you're listening to Edge Radio in Hobart, in 3BBB Ballarat, where you can find Radio Gold, or in 8CCC in the heart of the nation, Alice Springs. I'm Roderick Chambers. A recent report from late May has disclosed the Story Bridge in Brisbane is facing significant structural problems. This includes concrete deterioration, corrosion, and overloading on its pedestrian walkways. In light of bridge disasters globally in recent years, there's been discussions regarding the safety of aging bridges and the necessary for inspections. However, there is a solution, and it's structural health monitoring, a piece of technology which could solve the problem. Thomas Kudus asked Dr. Andy Nguyen, Senior Lecturer in Structural Engineering at the University of Southern Queensland, to explain what is structural health monitoring.
One of the key things from the real-time monitoring, structural health monitoring as we normally call it, is it provides a true picture about the bridge performance. So it's really about the performance of our structural system, bridges and dam and other structure. But here, of course, we talk about key bridges, like what I normally mention, the Story Bridge in Brisbane and so on.
Why do you think countries are slow and complacent to adapting bridge inspections, but more importantly, structural health monitoring? Should it be mandatory, do you think?
Yes, I think a couple of reasons. So first is in the previous period, the technology is not that developed. Council and other asset owner, they find it a little bit complicated to understand about the real benefit. And also we have some of the challenges with the upfront cost, like the access into the structure. That is sort of like the initial barrier. And the complexity of the multidisciplinary field like structural health monitoring is one of the barriers. Over the time, what we can see from around the world, and in particular with the bridge example in Canada, they have adopted and make use of the new technology, the recent advances, to really drive the technology-driven solution for asset management.
Which bridge collapse was the most preventable?
Actually, most of them are preventable. But we can see that the example I provided in my recent article, like the one in Italy, Morandi Bridge, preventable. It's preventable because, the problem is significant and it's clear. It's just because the inaction from the authority that actually caused a problem and make it worse. And also other bridges, like the one in 2007 in the U.S. Even though that bridge collapsed due to a previous design problem, if we make use of the smart monitoring technology, then those incidents can be prevented.
And is this something that all governments should be funding in?
I think that's a good question. In my views, the main cost should be provided by government, but we should have the collaboration between different level of government, because historical assets like the steel bridges we just discussed, including the Story Bridge, is not just the historical asset of the local government. It's the asset of the nation. All level of government should contribute financially to, make the maintenance more productive. And at the same time, private sector can also contribute. In my connection, I know that we have so many practicing engineers who are ready to contribute. They have a warehouse of sensors and other hardware that are ready to use.
Dr. Andy Nguyen, Senior Lecturer in Structural Engineering at the University of Southern Queensland, speaking there with Thomas Kudus.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire
on Community and Indigenous Radio right across Australia. Stay well.
The ACT has drafted new animal welfare laws that would legally require dog owners to spend a minimum of 3 hours a day with their pet. The purpose of these draft regulations ensures that the welfare of dogs in the ACT is being met by their owners in recognising them as sentient beings with emotional needs. Maeve Groom has this story.
Most dog owners can contest that our furry friends never leave our side, whether that be enjoying a walk together outside or lounging by our feet on the couch. But how would these fairly typical interactions change if the government required that we spend 3 hours minimum with our dogs? I asked Associate Professor Susan Hazel at the University of Adelaide's School of Animal and Veterinary Science if it is realistic to regulate something as personal and variable as human connection with a pet.
I don't think it's going to be something that can be effectively enforced or is all that helpful. But I think the discussion around what dogs actually need from us has been a helpful one and has provoked a lot of discussion in the community. I do think the majority of people that live closely with dogs are already providing that 3 hours.
Experts are also saying it's not just about the quantity of time, but the quality of time spent with your dog. What are some examples of meaningful, emotional, and supportive interactions between humans and dogs?
So just being together with them, I think dogs, as we've domesticated them over thousands of years, they do like contact with people. So just being close to people is something positive for them. And then it varies between individual dogs, but it might be things like playing with them, tug of war, throwing a ball, taking them for a walk and giving them time to sniff. Using their nose and smelling things is a really enriching experience for dogs. The other things would be just being with them, so possibly grooming them, if that's a positive experience for the dogs. Even hanging out and having them sitting at your feet or on the sofa with you as you watch TV, a lot of dogs, I think, probably do enjoy.
Are these draft regulations recognising dogs as more sentient beings in looking out for their welfare? What are these drafts trying to sort of say?
Yeah, so the basis in the ACT is the Animal Welfare Act, and the ACT was the first jurisdiction in Australia to recognise animal sentience as a basis for that legislation, which I think is a really positive thing. Animal sentience means an animal is capable of experiencing positive and negative emotions and other experiences. So, for example, they can experience happiness and joy and anticipation, positive anticipation. They can also experience fear and distress and pain. A sentient animal, those feelings matter to them and they should matter to us, so that we're not only preventing negative things happening to them, but we're providing them with as good a life as we can.
With separation anxiety affecting up to 29% of dogs, do you think more education is needed around dog and animal psychology and behaviour, especially as they've become so accustomed to human companionship?
Yeah, it's a great point that we not only focus on when we're with our dogs, but how long we leave them alone, and probably more education around that. I know there are some things you can do behaviour and training wise when puppies are small that can reduce the chance of them having distress. But in saying that, there will be a proportion of dogs that have anxiety and are going to get some separation related disorder no matter what you do with them. And it can be a really significant impact on both the owner, because the dogs can be quite destructive and bark a lot, but also it's terrible welfare for the dog. And yeah, having education and encouraging people to go and see an expert if they have a dog that's showing these signs is something that we should be thinking about more.
There's been a lot of discussion about how the ACT may struggle to enforce a rule like this in actual practice. So do you believe that the purpose is more about raising awareness than the actual policing about animal welfare?
I think that's what it will lead to, that it has encouraged this discussion. It's not going to be enforceable, and there's a whole argument around bringing in rules or regulations for people. On the whole, people don't like being told what to do. And if you bring in some rules that people know from the start nobody is going to be able to enforce them, then you do risk that they'll just ignore it. So that would be the only caveat that I would give.
Associate Professor Susan Hazel at the University of Adelaide School of Animal and Veterinary Science, speaking there with Maeve Groom. And And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.